Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Cyrano de Bergerac, King Lear, the other Josh Cohn, Barbara Cook's 85th birthday concert at Carnegie Hall, and other news and events in and around the Broadway community. Please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for Sunday, October 21st, 2012. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a writer who you could read at Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, at Critcherland on Fridays, and the MTI blog throughout the month. Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and a photographer. You can see his writing and his photography at BroadwayStars.com. You can see his photography at FileSpotPhoto.com. Michael also writes for outlets such as the Sondheim Review. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
Hello. So who is afraid of Virginia Woolf? Are either one of you?
Yeah.
Both of you got a chance to go see it, and it has just opened on Broadway. So Peter, why don't you give us a start on Virginia Woolf?
Sure. This is a pretty dramatic production. I've never seen one quite like it. And I didn't think I was going to like it at the beginning because Martha is not the harridan that we usually see when she comes in the door. She's just talking. She's talking a lot. She is asking the same questions, of course, about identifying a movie that many movie goers can tell you was Beyond the Forest, a Betty Davis picture of way back when. But anyway, the thing is, she isn't ferocious at all. And you think, oh, she's going to be lousy. And then you think, wait. On the other hand, this gives her a good distance to go. You know, it gives her someplace she can go to. And she does go there. I will admit, I don't think she's as severe as Uta Hagen originally, or Nancy Kelly, who I saw do the National Company, or Elaine Stritch. Well, I guess you'd imagine she'd be ferocious on the recording that she did, even for that matter, Elizabeth Taylor in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. They were all terrific. But this does give you pause because you do say, you know, there is something to be said for starting off a little quietly so you can build and build and build. So that's one thing that's really quite good. The other thing is Tracy Letts, who really is magnificent. One of the things that's so interesting about this is Pam MacKinnon's direction, because it is directed at a mile-a-minute pace. Oh, don't misunderstand me. It still takes a long time to get through this play. And they do keep it in three acts. In an age where so many three-act plays are done with one long first act and then a very short second, this one does have two intermissions. But the pace is so quick, especially when Tracy Letts is talking, because he can really get ferocious. I have heard people say, oh, it really does seem that he's the dominant partner in the relationship. I don't get that impression. I don't. But nevertheless, he certainly stands up for his rights more than I have seen other people do. But it's the pacing that's so interesting. And the thing is, I'm going to theorize here that 50 years ago, it was a case that this was such a heavy and dynamic play that we really needed to be spoon-fed it a little slower. But now that we all know it so well, we can really take it at a more feverish clip. So I thought that was really quite good. The two supporting people are really quite good, too, and especially the young woman who's playing Honey, because you know, I have to say that so many times in the 60s, the Oscars went to people who gave very mannered performances, and that certainly was Sandy Dennis for me in the movie of Virginia Woolf. I thought she was a little on the bizarre side. But this lady really does very well in calibrating getting drunk. She really is quite good indeed. And the guy playing Nick, who has this wonderful Brill Cream haircut, it really shines, is quite fine too, especially when he has to confront and stand up for his rights as well. So while this is not the land of Nick and Honey, it is the land of Martha and George, and they really are spectacular. So I was delighted that after having misgivings for the first 14, 18 seconds before I figured it out that this is something that was going to build, I really had quite a good time.
Great, Peter. Michael, did I misspeak? You didn't see Virginia Woolf yet, have you?
I have not seen it yet, but I am looking forward to seeing it all the more now. Amy Morton is a terrific actress. And I guess this is a wonderful example of someone taking an iconic role and, according to what Peter says, and doing it in a way it's never been done before, but is equally valid. I mean, certainly Uta Hagen and Elizabeth Taylor and Kathleen Turner and the other people Peter mentioned, they are very different from each other. But I do think that it has always been pretty much a constant that Martha is, as Peter said, a harridan. And it's always been played that way. And I am so looking forward to seeing this new interpretation of it. I'm so happy to hear that, Peter.
Well, now we'll see if we agree. Yeah.
Well, yes,
we've been known to disagree, Michael. You know,
yes, so. We have. But my point is, I mean, I do think that Amy Morton isn't one of our best actresses, and so I am not at all surprised actually to hear you say that. I'm really glad to hear that. I thought the last production was superb, with Kathleen Turner and Bill Irwin and David Harbour and Murray Enos, who was also excellent as Honey. If we've got another, it's that whole thing. How often do we need to see these plays? It wasn't done that long ago. I guess I'm in the school that if it's a great play and if it's a good production, whenever we can is my
well.
Answer.
Another thing too is so many of these shows, and this one included, is a limited run. So a result, under these circumstances, there are many people who don't have theater on their radar the way we do. So as a result, I got to go see Virginia Woolf. Oh, it closed last week. Oh, yeah, I want to go. In an era where about 10,000 people a week can go see any Broadway show, it's an arbitrary figure, but it's not so far off. No matter what we're talking about. This is a town of 8 million. There are a lot of tourists. I mean, people miss things. So as a result, how often it was here, how recently it was here, is irrelevant to most of the public. So as a result, we can be very much happy that anybody who does go this time around will have a very good production to see.
Can we talk about, for just a few minutes, about the importance of Steppenwolf in the American theater?
Isn't it something, huh?
I think we'd have to talk for more than a few minutes.
Oh, absolutely. But, it just seems like so many great things are happening at our sister city in Chicago that is what would we do without these great productions coming in? I mean, Steppenwolf has provided a steady stream of great productions for Broadway, and I'm kind of jealous that people in Chicago get to see it first.
Well, what's also interesting to me, I was in Maryland this weekend and in my hotel TV, and I turned it on, and there was Gary Sinise doing a commercial, and I thought, hey, here's a guy who started out in Chicago, and look, he's a major star. I mean, here he is doing a big commercial, and everybody knows who he is, of course, because he went out to Hollywood, but nevertheless, where were his roots, and they certainly were there. So as a result, you really have to be very impressed with just so many of them came out of there and really have become stars. I remember Raul Esparza telling me that when he was working there, when he told me the story, he said, and a company member there said to me, you can certainly make a living here and you'll certainly be very successful here in Chicago. But if you really want a name for yourself, you got to go to New York. I mean, it's too late for me, she said. Too late indeed, but it's not for you. And again, should you make the decision to stay here, fine. So anyway, he told me that right around the time he was doing Tick, Tick, Boom. When he was doing Speed the Plow, we did a panel discussion at the Drama League, and I mentioned this to him, and he said, yeah, you know what happened? That woman who said, that I'm staying here, I'm not going anywhere.
Was it Deanna Dunnigan?
Yeah, right, exactly. The lady who won the Tony for August Osage County. And the irony, of course, is Raul hasn't won a Tony, and there are those who felt he should have won one by now for Let Us Count the Ways. How many performances he's given that were worthy of them. So as a result, it is pretty interesting that the one who gave the advice turned out to spurn it herself and get the Tony. But who can blame her? I mean, we do want to see what's going on in Steppenwolf here in New York. So, and it is very nice, that there was a time when Steppenwolf, to many people, simply meant this rock band that was around late 60s.
Yes.
But now it's a little more rarefied, that name. So this company has really rescued it.
Yes, Raoul also spoke to me very, very fondly about Deanna Dunnigan. And yes, I mean, you know, it's one of those great things where quite late in life, there, she came to New York and she came to Broadway and she won a Tony. How fantastic.
Once again, proving there is enough time if we use it correctly. My little sermonette for the week.
Well, we have to see if we can get somebody from Steppenwolf to come join us and talk about how good they are. I can't say enough about them. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about something that you actually both have seen this week, Cyrano de Bergerac, which is a Roundabout Theater Company production. And Michael, want to just start us off with that?
I was very disappointed. It's a lovely production in terms of sets and costuming, and it looks like, you know, a fair amount of money was spent on it. It's quite a large cast. Roundabout Theater at the American Airlines Theater. God, I hate to say that name. Mm. And I know Peter is not fond of it either.
Well, I just say American.
That's right. What I think, yeah, so. But I have to say, Douglas Hodge is obviously a tremendously talented person. I quite loved him in La Cage aux Folles. I don't think he's playing the character as written. The character of Cyrano, aside from everything else, himself keeps saying, talking about his own panache. And whatever else Douglas Hodge has in this role, he seemed to me, his Cyrano was a very common person. At times he almost seemed, his accent almost seemed like a lower class Cockney British accent, working class accent. And I don't think panache is at all a very good description of the way he's playing the role. It has a lot of energy and it's very funny in some places, but kind of a common type of character. Also not terribly likable, in many points during the show. And obviously that's kind of a major flaw, I would say. I did not like his interpretation of the role at all. I thought Clemence Poésie was quite lovely as Roxanne. And I have to give them props for what it's worth. Whenever they pronounce the name Cyrano, they all said it in a beautiful French accent. So whoever's responsible for that should take a bow. I guess the staging part of it was quite well done by Jamie Lloyd. But also another tremendous liability, I thought, with this production is that they used a translation in rhyming couplets. And I don't know. I think it's very hard to get around that, even for the best, greatest actors, without making it sound sing-songy. And I don't think that they did succeed in that. So I think that was a bad decision from the beginning, and then compounded by this very unusual interpretation of Cyrano. I should mention Patrick Page was also quite good as the Comte de Guiche, but it just didn't gel for me. And I must say, there were quite a few empty seats even when the show started, and it did seem like quite a lot of people left at intermission. So I don't think that it's going over that well.
All right, Peter, what did you think about it?
Well, it's funny you should mention the walking out thing, because my girlfriend Linda is famous for leaving at the end of first acts if she feels her intelligence is being insulted too much. And you know, people like David Finkel and Mario Frati come up to her at intermission and always say, "So you staying?" You know, I mean, so anyway, Linda had to give a speech that night, so she couldn't go. So I took a friend who knows about Linda's proclivities very well and said, "Well, you know, at least you'll have something somebody here for the second act. Yeah, he walked out too. He couldn't stand it. And I think it's a very poor production. And Michael, I agree with you 1,000%. Douglas Hodge is doing such a Cockney that I expected him to say, have a banana. I mean, it was incredible.
So it wasn't just me.
It certainly wasn't you. I mean, maybe we're wrong or too sensitive to something, but I'll tell you, I had the exact same reading on it. One thing that should be mentioned is the nose that he wears, which is not the standard Cyrano nose. Now, I'm all for a different interpretation, but this one is truly repulsive. I mean, you know, this one really looks bulbous. It almost looks like a dodo beak, almost. But, I mean, it looks like it almost looks like he's had body modifications because it seems to almost be split in two right down the middle. And big lumps. I mean, it really is hideous.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, that it's I don't even know how people could look at him for any length of time. You know, you really have to steel yourself if you're going to do that. So I think that's a problem, too. And I understand the need to say, look, you know, we're not going to see that same beautifully tapered but long nose that, you know, sure, I'm all set there. And I know those things are expensive. You know, I remember when Robert Guillaume came into the musical Cyrano, they had to make a new nose because he's black and the original actor who played it was white. And, of course, one size doesn't fit all, I'm sure. So anyway, but I know that in that 1993 musical, it was a $5,000 nose, you know. So I know that these things are expensive, but it was so hideous, you know. So I think that was a big problem as well. I have to say that the guy I brought went on and on about how the performance that Clemens Posey gave as Roxanne, he said, reminds me of a college production when the girl who had the part had to do a term paper and her understudy came in. I thought she was very good. I liked her quite a bit. So, but it does seem to be a minority opinion with you and me, Michael. You know,
really?
So, it seems to be. And also, I have to admit that I always think that, and of course, you know, beauty's in the eye of the beholder, I'll grant you. You know, that's very true. But for me, the gentleman who played Christiane, Kyle Solier, didn't strike me as, you know, just one look, that's all it took. You know, I couldn't see falling in love with him at first sight. You know, he's just not that dynamic looking. Though, you know, I have to say that most of the Christians I've seen haven't been that dynamic looking. In that 93 production, the guy who was there, I didn't think was, you know, but again, you know, what appeals to me doesn't necessarily have anything to do with what appeals to Roxanne. But anyway, so he was, you know, he did the job and all that. I thought the direction was extraordinarily flat. It almost seemed like, you know, when you go to the bank and there's that big sheet of glass so you can't rob. You know, it seemed like to me there was a sheet of glass right in front of the proscenium because I just felt no connection with the audience at all with any of them. Now, I will say this. I thought Douglas Hodge was excellent in his final scene. I liked him there. And I said, now I understand the good reviews. You know, because he did get good reviews aside from, you know, Michael and me. But I think that might have been what put him over for a lot of people because he's very tender in that scene and very loving. Though, you know, I have to say this has never been one of my favorite plays. I find it very interesting that the Christiane is supposed to be this, you know, dumbbell who can't come up with the right word at the right time. And yet there's that famous interchange when Cyrano's talking before he knows who he is. Neither one of them knows who the other one is, you know, and, you know, by a nose, he makes a lot of puns using the word nose, Christiane does. And, you know, so he seems a little smarter to me. If there were even a line saying, oh yeah, I'm really good with words, but you know, when I'm a woman, I clam up, you know, I just can't do it. That would save it for me. But nobody ever says that in any of the translations I've ever seen. And I agree, you know, no can do is not something I want to hear in a production of Cyrano de Bergerac. So I thought about taking my leave, I will admit, with my buddy, you know, and go hoist a few, but duty called, and I said, no, I've got to see it through to the end. And to a degree, I'm glad I stayed because I did see that last scene and I thought he was good. But still, to me, this is one of the worst Cyranos I've seen of the seven I've seen. And that even includes one in Riverside Park, you know, I mean, you know, where a bunch of just starting out actors, you know, get out there and do it. So, yeah.
Yeah. I actually felt the second act in general was significantly better than the first. Maybe partly because it was so much shorter.
Yeah, that could be.
Yeah, this is another one. I imagine the play is this one of those cases where they did two acts together as Act One and then Act Three as Act Two. Is that?
It
seems like it because Act One was much longer than Act Two, Anyway.
All righty. So let's move on from Cyrano on to a King Lear. Michael got a chance to see a production of it. Why don't you tell us which one and how you felt about it?
Oh, it was the American Bard Theater Company production of King Lear. And it was done at St. Mary's Church. Do you know that church, Peter? Well, I guess you might.
I'm not sure. Is this one on 46th Street?
Yes. The
new roundabout space. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And I didn't realize that I may have been there once before. There's a theater space upstairs, sort of black boxy, you know. Well, that it is actually black boxy, actually. And anyway, they did a very strong production of King Lear with Stephen Mohannon as the title character, who many of you may know from Cats and Peter Pan with Kathy Rigby and Pirates of Penzance, the Joe Papp production. He's got quite a wonderful resume, and he was terrific. Again, a very different interpretation, a very theatrical interpretation of King Lear, almost as if he was an old actor, you know, kind of giving it up and retiring. But, you know, I think it's fair to say that a great many politicians and royalty, many of them have a theatrical flair to them. So it certainly seemed very appropriate. And it just was a very nice, very simple production in terms of sets and costumes. But there was some doubling that happened because it's another play with a very large cast. But even that was done very well. And just extremely, extremely well done and well directed. It's good to see good direction when you don't expect it in a small, very small, tiny situation like that. I've been complaining about major basic missteps by people like Doug Hughes and Bartlett Sher, who work all the time on Broadway and at the Metropolitan Opera. But here, this director, Dev Bondarin, you know, does a really excellent job with this very solid production of King Lear. And I recommend it if it's, let's see, it's going through November 4th. So try to catch up with it if you can. I don't think you'll regret it.
I have to, because I've been a Steve fan since 1967, when I saw him at Harvard. He and Stalker Channing, she was Susan Channing then, with the LaFontaine of Harvard. I mean, they did so many shows together. And I discovered her first in 66 when she was Luca in Arms and the Man in Rep, playing the girl in The Lesson, who has a tough time with her teacher. And but I remember vividly, still to this day, March 5th, 1967. You'll check. Go ahead. It was a Sunday night. I remember it vividly, where he played A Flea in Her Ear, which, as Neil Simon says, is the funniest play ever written. And he has to play two parts. He has to play a rather noble guy, and he has to play a servant who people kick around. And, of course, with the mistaken identity, a lot can happen. He was so magnificent, and I never missed anything he did at Harvard after that. Even when he directed The Dybbuk, I had to go because I was just so enraptured by this performer. And so then, in 1978, I'm in New York, and I go to Central Park to see All's Well That Ends Well, a fabulous production by Wilfred Leach. And God, it looks so much like Steve Kaplan, but it says Stephen Hannon, and I said, it must be the same guy, you know. And I love that All's Well so much that I went five times.
Wow.
And one time while going, one time while going, I saw him and I said, excuse me, are you Steve Kaplan? He said, yeah. I said, I thought so. God, you were so great at Harry. He said, tell him. And he grabbed the guy he was walking with, and it was Wilfred Leach, you know, the director. Because Steve had a very small part in that All's Well That Ends Well, but he certainly didn't have a small part, indeed, when Wilfred Leach did Pirates of Penzance. Mm. And yes, he did get a Tony nomination for playing Gus the Theater Cat in Cats. And though there's a funny story there, too, because I remember the day he got the part, and he's walking down the street, and he has the cat's button on, and he's so proud of it. And you know, about a year or two later, you know, he wasn't wearing the button anymore. And anytime I saw him, you know, I was like, oh, the costume weighs a ton. I hate it. So it was very hard for him to continue with Cats. But nevertheless, I've always enjoyed him. And so I'm certainly going to go see his King Lear. And thank you for reminding me. And thank you for telling me I have a couple of weeks to do it.
I think you'll be very pleased. It was very well done overall. The entire cast was excellent. I must also single out the fellow who played Edmund. Edmund, his name is Montgomery Sutton, and he was the best Edmund I've ever seen.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, a really difficult role, one of these, you know, very malevolent characters, you know, and then who does a complete turnaround in the last 30 seconds of his life or so. But he really nailed it. I think you're going to really enjoy it, Peter.
Good.
So that's at the American Bard Theater Company at St. Mary's Church in Times Square. It's 143 West 46th, and it's playing now through November 4th. So if you do want to see it, you will have a few weeks to check that out.
Yeah.
Peter, you got a chance to see Josh Cohen.
The other Josh Cohen, this is a musical in the sense that certainly songs are sung, but it really plays more as a play with music. But it's terrific. It is so wonderful and so winning. There are two Josh Cohens on stage. One is Josh narrating his life, and the other one is the guy playing him. So you assume that that's what you're talking about, that one of those two guys is the other Josh Cohen. Not at all. It takes a while to get to this point, but what does happen is you find that this Josh Cohen one day opened his mail and saw that he got a check for $56,000 from an Irma Cohen who said, you know, I want you to have this, you know, and he thought, I don't know an Irma Cohen. What's going on here? Maybe I should investigate. And of course, all his friends are saying to him, cash the check. Shut up. Just cash the check. And his parents even say, cash. You know, he says, do we have a relative named Irma? Well, maybe we do, you know, cash the check. But he's so full of integrity that he doesn't want to just do that. And more to the point, he's the type of guy who could really use the money because he's bounced around in jobs. And at the moment, he's unemployed. He doesn't have a girlfriend, which he really wants to. And as anybody can tell you, in New York City, when you don't have any money, it's harder to find a girlfriend than when you do have money. So, I mean, he has a very tough time with that, too. It all works out quite splendidly. Not necessarily the way that you'd predict, which is one of the great joys of the show. A lot of folk rocky type music. The narrator has a guitar and plays it quite a bit. There's a small pit band. It's on stage, but with a female drummer who loves to hit those drums. I tell you, they occasionally play parts too. And there's an actress who plays a million roles and does them all very, very well. So as a result, this was a delightful surprise. And it was funny because Linda and I attended that after we saw Virginia Woolf, and we were walking around saying, two great shows on the same day. I mean, when has this ever happened to us? You know, I mean, really. And Linda's staying in her seat for both shows. I mean, you know, this is unheard of. So it really is a terrific little sleeper, and I wish it well. It's down at the Soho Playhouse, which is on Van Dam Street. Very easy to get to by the E train. Depending on where you get out, you can actually get out on the same street, Van Dam. You know, I don't know where you're going to be in the car, but anyway. so it's not hard to find, and I really think it's worth investigating. Everybody in it is charming. It's very, very sweet in the best sense of the word, and it took me totally by surprise. I didn't know what to expect, but it didn't take long before it was I had a wonderful grin on my face, which never left. So I wish it well.
Well, that's an amazing compliment, Peter, to see anything right after Virginia Woolf. I mean, because Virginia Woolf, aside from being one of the great plays, is quite a, you know, it's long and it's very emotionally exhausting.
Sure.
So that is a great compliment.
Yeah, I hope it goes over. I mean, it's going to be hard for it to succeed because it's at this out of the way place, and not only that, you know, it doesn't have anybody you've ever heard of, and I'm not even sure the title is. It's one of those titles that you really appreciate after you see the show, but not before you see the show. So I am squarely in its corner. And while I wish, as always, that it had perfect rhymes and accents on the correct syllables, it is folk rock music, and as a result, it doesn't seem as egregious when it happens in that as opposed to traditional show music. So, but yeah, I wish somebody more skillful could have come in and spruced up the lyrics a bit. But that is a minor complaint, because what they got right was the sweetness and making you care about this guy, and not saying, yeah, what a loser, what do I care what happens? No, not at all. You really do, you know, because he really tries to do the right thing. And how many of us would, you know, if we got that check in the mail, would we? He really goes above and beyond to find out the real story behind this check. So so that's pretty interesting.
I don't know. I changed my name to Josh Cohn.
Cash in a
check.
Minute, sure. You bet.
I don't know about that. It's a tough times all around. So Josh Cohn is down at the Soho Playhouse on 15 Van Dam Street, and it's playing through November 11th. So fit that in between your Lears and your Virginia Woolfs. So much of the stuff is coming up on us quickly. Speaking of which, limited engagements, Michael got a chance to see the inestimable Barbara Cook, who has been singing with us for how many odd years there, Michael?
Well, her first Broadway show was Flahoolie. What year, Peter? 54?
51.
51.
May 14th, 1951.
Oh my
May
God.
14th it opened. Yeah, Flahoolie was a big show for me. Not that I saw it, but I mean, it was an album I went crazy trying to find, so I know everything about it. Yeah, so that's you can bank on it. 40 performances at the Broadhurst. So she's
61
been around.
Years.
Yeah.
61, and this was her, is it 85th birthday concert, Michael?
Yes, her actual 85th birthday is this coming week, October 25th, but she celebrated it at Carnegie Hall last week, and it was quite something, as you might imagine. It was very simple. You've heard this phrase before, or this description, and I, so forgive me if it sounds trite. She turned Carnegie Hall into an intimate little cabaret room. She only had three or four musicians. And she sat for the entire program that she sang because she's had some problems lately with mobility. So she walked out with a cane, and then she sat and she sang. And she also did not do, a single musical theater number. She sang standards, pop and jazz standards from the Great American Songbook. And it was really a very, very, very special night. The audience was in the palm of her hand. Just in the past couple of years, she does seem to have the power in her voice seems to have diminished somewhat. And there were some, I felt like sometimes she was singing more carefully. But still, I mean, for an 85-year-old woman to sound like that, it's almost incomprehensible. And I've always said that she should will her vocal cords to science, because it's amazing. You know, there's it's almost unprecedented, especially for someone who, you know, is basically a soprano. You know, the lower voice singers, especially females, tend to have greater longevity, but it's just not usual for someone who's basically a soprano to retain that kind of beauty and through the years. And also, she's always been a great interpreter of lyrics. Someone who, I think it was Sheldon Harnick, one of the people who spoke, said something to the effect that she, from the beginning, from the very earliest recordings that you listen to, it's obvious that she was very connected to the lyrics in the way that a true musical theater performer should be. And that's informed every other kind of music that she's sung. So it was a great night. And I'm very, very glad I was there.
I got to say that I once asked Barbara Cook if more people remembered her birthday since Terrence McNally's play, Love, Valor, Compassion, came out, because in it, it's actually mentioned, because somebody mentions October 25th, and the Nathan Lane character said, Barbara Cook's birthday, you know, and she said, indeed, that more people have remembered it since that play came out. And it reminded me, I was talking to Varla Jean Merman this week. Do you know about this, Michael? She's going to be doing The Medium. Do you know this?
I saw her or him do it.
Oh, in Provincetown?
Yes, I did.
How is it?
It was very good.
Good. And it's interesting you say it that way, because Varla Jean Merman is actually, the name is what, Michael? Is it James Roberson?
Jeff Roberson.
Okay. And he said, you know, while the words Varla Jean and Merman will be mentioned in the advertising, just so they know who I am, this is really me, Jeff, who's performing it. You know, yes, I will be dressed as a woman because the medium is a woman. But nevertheless, I'm going to be doing it. I'm really going to be doing it straight. I really am. I mean, so don't look for a hoot fest. But anyway, my point is that the character of Varla Jean Merman is supposed to be the love child of Ethel Merman and Ernest Borgnine. And I asked him, I said, did you get many condolences when Ernest Borgnine died in July? Oh, yeah. People are calling me and say, oh, we feel terrible. Your father has died. You know what I mean? So we do have a wonderful way of mixing fact with fiction in our theatrical sensibilities.
Michael, let me ask you a question. Was Barbara Cook's concert a one-night-only event?
Oh, yes, very much so, yeah.
So, because I read in Stephen Holden's review in the New York Times that she had some special guests at the end.
Yes, she had Josh Groban. She had Jessica Mulaski and John Pizzarelli. And she had the wonderful Metropolitan Opera star, Susan Graham, who sang an unplugged version of Till There Was You, which was really quite something. Oh, and let me not forget our friend Sheldon Harnick, who sang a special version of the title song from She Loves Me with new lyrics that he wrote that were absolutely delightful. The first two lines were something like, the first few lines were something along the lines of, I love you and I've loved you truly since I saw you starring in Flahooli.
Excellent.
I mean, it was more elegant than that, but that was basically that was the rhyme. And it just went on from there and mentioned all of her Broadway shows. And you know, he's got a great voice, Sheldon Harnick. Have you heard him sing, Peter?
Yes. Oh, sure.
Yeah.
And there's something about a lyricist singing his own words that really is quite wonderful. And his recording when he was at the Lyrics and Lyricists way back when is really quite sensational. And you can hear a little bit of it. You can't find the CD of it. It does exist, but if you can't find it, there's a little of it on the Fiddler on the Roof deluxe edition that Masterworks Broadway puts out, where you hear him sing that when Messiah Comes, which is a phenomenal song. And the audience goes crazy for it. He has to stop. He really stops the show with it. He really does. He has to wait and for everybody to stop laughing and applauding. They're just having such a good time. Yeah, he's a wonderful, wonderful interpreter of what he does.
I don't know if you guys feel the same way, but I'm always amazed when I hear a composer or a lyricist sing their own work, and I stop and think, wow, they could have been they could have been a performer in their own right on the highest levels. A lot of them, not all of them, certainly. Some of them are certainly terrible singers, but many of them are just. I think of the Jason Robert Browns. If Jason Robert Brown didn't write a Broadway show in his whole life, I think that he could have performed on Broadway easily.
There are a few others. Harold Arlen was.
That's what I was going to mention.
Harold Arlen.
That's
and
a unique voice. Nobody sounds like Harold Arlen. It's kind of breezy. It's reedy. And I will admit, you know, that a lot of the public might not take to it, but it really is a distinctive voice, to the point of which he even recorded an album on Columbia Records. Yeah, Barbara Streisand helped on a couple of songs, but it's really his album, and Harold sings Arlen. It's called, it's a terrific disc. I think it's still in print, and it's definitely well worth having. I think Charles Strauss is very good at singing his own material too.
Charles Strauss and Cy Coleman.
Cy Coleman was wonderful doing it. Yeah.
And you know, it's funny you mentioned it, because I had NPR on today, and they had Bobby Lopez on with a wonderful interview about Book of Mormon, and he sang two or three numbers from it, or sections of them anyway. And the host even commented on the fact of, well, you're certainly a better singer than most composers.
Certainly on the applause demo, Charles Strauss sounds better than Lauren Bacall did.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, Michael, you just came back from Broadway Originals. Were there any composers or lyricists there singing their own works?
No, and it was quite an amazing addition because, well, several things about it. First of all, I have to say, there was a lot of talent assembled, but it was very dispiriting in the sense that a significant amount of the program was made up of songs that were not written for the Broadway stage by any stretch of the imagination, and have, you know, but have been used in one or another type of jukebox musicals. And, you know, it's okay, you know, if that happens sometimes, but when you realize how often it's been happening in recent years, it really gets kind of scary.
Sure.
For example, Mandy Gonzalez was there, and yes, she sang her wonderful song from the amazingly wonderful show In the Heights, but she also sang that song from Dance of the Vampires, the one that's interpreted. What is the title of Total Eclipse of the Heart?
My Heart, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, can you imagine in a Broadway concert? And then Elizabeth Stanley, you know, the wonderful Elizabeth Stanley, she sang You Could Drive a Person Crazy from Company, but she also sang Fever, the old
Peggy Lee
song, because that was in the tremendously horrible show, Million Dollar Quartet. So, and there were several others that along that stripe. So I have to say that was a little disconcerting. The best songs were from the old shows. Matt Cavanaugh sounded really amazing on Maria, I have to say, complete with a high B flat. I think that's the note that was truly excellent. So that was really quite something. And Barbara Walsh did Stop Time from Big, which I really love.
I just saw Big in Glen Echo, Maryland, in a children's production. I was wondering if they were going to keep that in there, and they did. I don't know if it's a good idea to keep in a kid's production, but nevertheless, it is such a beautiful song, isn't it?
It really, it truly, really, truly is. And Alice Ripley did both. That was interesting, too. She did I Miss the Mountains from Next to Normal. But she also did Who Will Love Me As I Am, sans Emily Skinner. She did it as a solo. So that was interesting. And Laura Osnes was there, and she sang from Bonnie and Clyde. But the most interesting thing about the afternoon was that I guess at sort of the last minute, they got Jill Pace and Ryan Silverman, who would have been the two leads in Rebecca, to sing three songs from the show. So I think if only from a historical standpoint, that was really quite something. But I have to tell you, those songs were really, really, really not good at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting to hear the audience reaction, because they were trying to be supportive.
Yeah,
and
the
performances were wonderful, but really very, very pedestrian, very third-rate, maybe fourth-rate music and lyrics. I mean, I'm sorry the way it happened, but I don't think it's a bad thing that the show never wound up coming to Broadway.
It's funny because there was an expo at the Minskoff Theater on Monday, and I was asked to speak there. What this is teachers come, and every, not every, but most Broadway shows have a little table set up saying, here's why you should bring your students to our show. It's a nice thing. But I was talking about the fact that, by and large, you know, Broadway show songs are a higher level than pop songs, by and large. I mean, you know, everybody can come up with exceptions to every rule, and the devil can cite scripture to serve his purpose. But nevertheless, I was mentioning that sometimes kids get too affected by songs, and people do too, not just kids. I mean, adults, because there was that incident in 1994 at the Hip Hop Awards when there was a song called Throw Your Guns, and the guy who was singing it was so moved to take out his gun and shoot at the ceiling. You know, I mean, so, so, you know, Michael, maybe fever isn't so bad when one thinks of Throw Your Guns, you know, I mean, so maybe we're lucky and we didn't know it, it could have been worse, because I don't know about you, but when my son gets married, I hope that he and his bride do not choose Throw Your Guns as their first song when they dance. You know, I mean, that's what I hope. So,
well, for
so
that matter, you know, and for that matter, Tonya Pinkin sang from Play On, and that's Duke Ellington. And,
yeah, sure.
You know, I mean, that wasn't written for Broadway either, but that's Duke Ellington.
No.
You know, so
yeah.
I don't know. It's just,
no, yeah. I certainly get your point, believe me. So.
All righty, so let's move on to the Alan Menken tribute at the National Arts Club, where I heard that there was a special drop-in guest, wasn't there, Michael?
Yes, it was really quite something. The National Arts Club, for those of you who don't know it, is a incredibly beautiful place on Gramercy Park. And it's right next to, literally, the Players Club, which is very venerable, you know, for theater folk. And so there was this terrific tribute to Alan Menken with several of his lyricists there, Glenn Slater and David Zippel. And who am I leaving out?
Jack Feldman?
Yes, I'm sorry, Jack Feldman from Newsies. And they all spoke and or performed. And then we had terrific people like Clea Blackhurst and Ron Raines and Titus Burgess and Karen Mason and Karen Ziemba and Lindsay Mendez. It was Carol Lindsay from Newsies, Farrah Alvin, Scott Coulter performing these terrific songs. You know, when you hear them in a string like that from all of these different projects for the theater and for film, is it obvious to say, I think he's really, really great. I mean, he's won tremendous amounts of awards. I think maybe he's not on Broadway, maybe he's not as appreciated as he should be, only in the sense that some of the things did not go over that well for one reason or another. But Newsies is, you know, I think is quite a big hit. So maybe appreciation of Alan Menken will only increase. And I certainly hope so. So at the beginning, there was a cocktail reception before the performances. And who showed up but Angela Lansbury? by mistake, in the sense that she was going next door to the Players Club to some kind of a tribute or program for Audra McDonald. But of course, Angela Lansbury sang Beauty and the Beast in the movie and created that wonderful role of Mrs. Potts and was the first person to sing that beautiful song. So it was really kind of wonderful. And she came in and she realized she was in the wrong place. And she went over to talk to Alan Menken and they spent some time together and she took some photos and then she went next door. So that was really a terrific thing. And by the way, I said to her, I said, oh, Miss Lansbury, I thought that you had already left for Australia because she's going to do Driving Miss Daisy with James Earl Jones. And she said, oh, no, January 1st, I think she said. Mm-hmm. So, and I said, is there any chance that you all might bring it back here when you're done? And she said something to the effect of, well, everything is possible, but of course it was just done a few years ago. So I don't know. Maybe, you know, who knows, maybe they could do it as a one-night benefit. Wouldn't that be fantastic?
Well, as someone who saw Pretty Belle four times, I can tell you Angela Lansbury could be very good with that Southern accent. She really does it like butter, and she does it extraordinarily well. And if you get the Pretty Belle Cast album, and I urge you to do so, you'll hear that she's really, really at home with a Southern accent.
Well, and of course, she just did it in The Best Man.
So, yeah, that's right. She was a Southern character there, too.
All right. So let's transition out of our reviews into our discussion of this week's news. At the top of the news, and which has dominated the news for the last couple of weeks, is, of course, the ordeal around the Broadway show Rebecca and the financing. And at first, we heard that the federal government, I guess the FBI, has arrested the financier who had promised to bring in some of the money for the show. That turned out that never could he deliver, and he seems to have absconded with some money from the show. And then the second shoe that dropped is that the producers of Rebecca filed a $100 million lawsuit against this same guy who got arrested. So Rebecca is far from playing out.
Can either of you gentlemen please explain to me how this person ever thought he could get away with this?
Yeah, that is bizarre, isn't it?
I just don't understand it. He invented four people who were supposedly going to give millions of dollars to this show. I mean, did he think – where did he think – how did he think it was not going to come back to bite him in the butt? I mean, you know, the money – either was going to come from somewhere or it wasn't. And it was, you know, did he think he could keep the fiction alive that these people were real? And of course he couldn't, because there was no money to show.
It's almost like, thinking about Bernard Madoff, and how did Bernard Madoff think that Ponzi scheme could ever keep existing and perpetuating itself? But people are nuts. And
I guess so, but it just seems so obvious that it would have that in a fairly
eventually
short,
would crash to the ground. Yeah,
well,
surely.
and in a fairly short amount of time, because when push came to shove with the opening of the show, I mean, with Madoff, yes, you're right, James, but I mean, he could have conceivably gone on for years, just having, you know, with a pyramid scheme, it can go on for a really long time as more and more gullible people are brought into it, but. Something had to be shown for his efforts that he was supposedly getting a commission on, the money that he was supposedly bringing in, which didn't exist because the people who supposedly had it were not real. So I don't know what he was thinking.
Who knows?
Did he think he was going to skip the country before
oh, that's
he
a good
was
point.
Arrested?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's the I only thing I can.
Yeah, think. I can't imagine he was going to skip the country for just $60,000 that he gotten in.
Well, maybe there are other things too. Maybe he just needed the $60,000 to get out of the country.
Yeah,
you know, that could very well be.
You know, I'm sure that we're going to hear more and more of this as this develops in throughout the news. And
it's very interesting how we've heard so much already. I mean, justice was swift here.
It really was.
It
was very, very high profile, and seemingly at this. Gentleman that has been arrested had there are other things ongoing as well with him that prompted the FBI to jump in there. You know, perhaps this gentleman read from Theater Communications Group released their 32nd annual report that not-for-profit theaters added $1.94 billion to the economy. Could you imagine? I mean, we're just talking about Steppenwolf, and we're talking about the other major nonprofits like the Roundabout Theater Company and La Jolla Playhouse and Paper Mill Playhouse and all these other places around the $1.94 billion into the economy. This is yet another reason that we should get our kids involved in theater.
That's the same number of bed bugs that were found backstage at the ArcLight Theater, too, as I understand it. Did you hear about that?
The production
of the balcony. There was going to be Jean Genet's The Balcony done there, but unfortunately, there was a bed bug infestation at the ArcLight Theater. I should mention that so everybody's warned. Yes, they are going to be exterminating, and I guess they'll take care of the problem. But for those of us who may be a little more squeamish than others, it might be a theater that we might not be as interested in going to as a result of this. But I mean, this is a first. I mean, maybe they don't have the money either and decide to blame it on bed bugs. But nevertheless, that's the official explanation. Michael, did you hear about this?
No, but that's a perfect segue to say that Bed Bugs the Musical is about to open at the Shurushin Theater. So,
yeah. There is a show called Bed Bugs, right? So I'm telling you, they're everywhere in one way or another.
Oh, my goodness gracious. You know, after last week's discussion about Sarah Brightman going to the moon, nothing shocks us, does it?
Well, I don't know if she's going to the moon. She's going to space.
Was it you last week that said it can't be far enough?
somebody said it's not far enough for me.
All righty. So, you know who must have been shocked about the headlines this week? The Public Theater, because Barry Edelstein named the artistic director of another great not-for-profit theater, the Old Globe in San Diego. Mm-hmm. So Barry is at the Public Theater now, and he will be moving over to the Old Globe in San Diego and moving out to the West Coast. Quite a shock. Question mark or blow? I think that he's
surprised as well.
Very influential and important in the public theater.
Oh, yeah.
Especially on the heels of the large $40 million renovation project at the public.
That said, though, all of us would be interested in getting a job where we're the boss and make all the important decisions. And one doesn't have to live in New York all his life. As that line in Company goes, there's a time to come to New York and a time to leave New York. When you get a job offer like that, maybe it is time to leave, at least for a while. So, you get good weather, why not?
It's very pretty out there.
It is. Oh. It is. I've been to the Old Globe. It's very nice.
The Old Globe is quite a theater, isn't it?
Yeah, I had a good time out there seeing the Chargers play football and then seeing a nice play called Emily, which I wish something had happened to. This, I think, was in 1986 or so. But nevertheless, I'm very fond of the Old Globe.
Great. So in other news, coming out of Chicago once again, we talked about Virginia Woolf earlier, but Iceman Cometh and Follies took the top honors at Chicago's Jeff Awards, which is their the local Chicago awards for the best theater productions, and makes me wonder again if the Iceman will cometh. Maybe next season. I don't know.
I don't think so. But since we're talking about awards, I felt very bad to learn that Philadelphia's Barrymore Awards apparently are not happening anymore.
No, really?
Yeah, the funding disappeared for that.
Oh,
so I hope. Yeah, really, every city should have those. It's quite a nice thing. And I mean it had really made a name for itself. We knew what a Barrymore Award was. We knew in what city it was given. And so I hope somebody can step up to the plate and continue the Barrymore Awards. How about Drew Barrymore? She's got some money, right? I mean, she...
Yeah, exactly. That's a good idea.
Yeah, I think that's...
Hello?
James?
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. I was on mute there.
Okay.
So Bring It On is cutting extension short. It's set a new closing date for December 30th instead of in the middle of January. Do we think that...
just for the record, that was an extension.
Extension, sure.
Yeah.
And then took back some of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
I loved it. I loved it. I loved it.
I liked it quite a bit as well, and I wish it had been more successful. I just wonder if there's just too much teenage musical stuff out there, with Glee and the High School Musical phenomenon. I just wonder if people just don't want to see things about high schoolers in musicals for a while. Maybe that's it. That's only a guess, but because I really think it's a rewarding show.
It's quite possible. But I also do think, and you know, I guess maybe I do it too. I'm unhappy when people decide they're not going to like something based on what they think it's going to be and what, you know, and what the subject matter is. This happened with, I remember this happened with The Wedding Singer, another show that I really, really liked. And I think a lot of people thought it was just a one joke 80s show. And so they didn't go. And in this case, people are like, well, you know, why do I want to go see this musical about high school cheerleaders? Well, I don't have any specific interest in high school cheerleaders, but I thought it was a terrific show. Mm-hmm. And, so I'm sorry if we all have to make decisions, as you know, especially,
sure,
you know, based on, you know, on our wallet, aside from everything else. And it's easy for me to say, because I, you know, usually don't have to pay, but in this case, if someone didn't see it because they thought they wouldn't like it because it's about high school cheerleaders, I think that's unfortunate, because I really think it was terrific.
All righty. But with the cutback for Bring It On, is this maybe a bellwether for what else is happening on Broadway? There's certainly lots and lots of rumors about Chaplin not quite making its numbers and having a limited life. I'm not sure if we were talking with you guys or somebody else that had expressed expressed surprise that Chaplin is still out there.
They just sent out a press release announcing that they're selling tickets through when is it, Peter?
June.
Through June, yeah.
June.
I think that they were trying to say that they're going to make it to the Tonys.
You know, that's easy to say. You know, I mean, and still, they are trying to come across as a hit, and they are working very hard. They're starting to appear on shows, and they're doing all they can. So it's good producing, no question about it. You know, and you know, sometimes when a show stays around long enough, you know, that becomes its reputation, that it's there, so it must have something. So good luck to it. I hope it's pleasing people. It didn't please me particularly, but nevertheless, I have to say I know a lot of people who liked it. So
I was just about to say the same thing. I've recently spoken to several people who are not necessarily diehard theater goers who saw it, right, and they really enjoyed it very, very much.
Mm-hmm. I've had the same experience. So there.
So the grosses on Chaplin, if you look on it on a line graph, are an increasing trend. So they were playing, you know, in the 80% range in the last couple of weeks, and pulling in the $525,000 range. So, and that's progressively been getting better week by week. They started in the $300,000 range. So
really, that's wonderful.
I think they're doing well, but I just hear lots of people saying that they're burying them, but we will see who will be able to come out in the final blows and be correct here. Very interesting. In our last topic that we're going to talk about tonight before we wrap up is that Andrew Lloyd Webber is calling on the British government for a serious investment in arts education. And I thought that was interesting in the fact that we are in a very political time right now. Only being, you know, a matter of weeks before the presidential election here in the United States. And I do not hear of any major artists or institutions calling for investment in arts education. And maybe I'm missing it, but I was wondering if you guys have heard of anybody going out there and saying that.
Carol Channing.
Carol Channing is doing that.
She has made that a very strong cause of hers in recent years, and I think that's wonderful. It seems like there are periods, there are times when people really come out strongly for that. I think maybe they feel there's so much worse things going on right now that maybe it's. You know, I mean, look at what happened with the discussion of the PBS defunding and the Big Bird scandal and all that stuff. You know, which I mean, that's arts education, isn't it? In a way,
of course it is. Yeah, of course it is. When I was talking at the Arts Expo the other day, I was talking about the time the three kids, I think it was in Washington State, went into a classroom and shut up their classmates while they were dressed in the same costumes as characters in the movie Natural Born Killers. And as I pointed out, I never recall hearing a story where kids went into a classroom killing people dressed as Henry Higgins, Captain Von Trapp, and Tevye. You know, I mean, I just haven't heard that. So arts education is very important. You know, let's get nice ideas in people's heads, and it has to happen. I mean, if we're saving people, what are we saving them for, you know?
That's a very good point. Very good point. So,
yeah, but, you know, well, you know, not to get too political, but do not look for any of that to ever happen if the Republicans get into power. So,
well,
you know,
as long as we weren't getting political.
That's right.
Well, I mean, no, but I mean, I think I can say that without any fear of contradiction. You know, I just don't think they think that's anything that's remotely important. So aside from everything else, don't expect arts education funding under the Republicans.
Words to live by, Michael.
Absolutely. All righty. So if you have a differing point of view, you might want to go to BroadwayRadio.com, and you have our contact information for Michael, Peter, and me, and you can let us know your points of view on that. Also, if you go to Broadway Radio, you can see links to all the articles that we've talked about, and we have some nice videos from some productions this week as well on that page. You could also find the archive of everything else that we have recorded over the last couple of years if you want to go back and take a listen to earlier things we said, plus contact information, Twitter, Facebook, all different stuff. I want to remind you also you could subscribe to these podcasts by going to the Broadway Radio page, and there's a subscribe button. Anyway, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. We'd love it if you went to iTunes and left us some positive feedback and gave us a good review, because that will help Apple promote This Week on Broadway to their front page and let other people who love Broadway listen to our show. You could listen to Broadway Radio on Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. And also wanted to thank everybody who has contacted me for listener volunteer help. We would love to hear from you still. If you have a few hours, then you'd like to help us out expanding Broadway Radio in lots of different ways, either by doing transcripts for us or helping us with the website or doing various other types of tasks that would help us make Broadway Radio better. Please send me an email at james@broadwayradio.com. So what else is going on this week for you guys? Anything new coming up that we should be aware of?
What am I doing? I'm going to a few readings, actually. Well, I'm seeing him at 59... East 59th by A Foot Girl, and what I mean is one of the Horton Foot relatives. I'm going to Freedom of the City, a play that was on Broadway in the 70s and didn't do well, but Irish Rep is doing it, so that's good news, because they really do good work. And I'm going to the Medium. I want to see Jeff Robeson do that. And then I'm off to Cincinnati, where I teach my master class twice a year, and I'll be seeing chess there. And God knows what that's going to be like, because, you know, chess is always different no matter when you see it. So it'll be very interesting to see what version it is, what they have, what they drop, what book, no book, who knows. So I'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, chess is the thing that is always, everybody's saying, oh, this production is going to be revived on Broadway.
That's
this
right.
is the one that's going to make it. And so we'll go see, you know.
That's right.
And chess is a great production for a college age cast.
I agree.
To do. Mm-hmm. So it's Freddie High Screaming Notes that you seem to have to be able to do when you're young. Michael, what's coming up for you?
Well, I wanted to remind everyone this is the second and final week for Fade Out, Fade In at Musicals Tonight, which is a show that you certainly are not going to have many opportunities to see. This was the show that starred Carol Burnett, but and with music by Julie Stein and book and lyrics by Betty Comden and Adolf Green. And it's really quite hilarious and delightful and funny, but it was a flop on Broadway for
reasons that are really very complicated, and I won't get into them now. Burnett was injured in a cab accident, and then she had to leave the show, and she didn't feel she could come back, and anyway, it just closed.
Or she didn't want to.
Or she didn't want to, depending on whom you speak with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yes, it's really quite a wonderful, you know.
You've seen this production, Michael?
Yes, yes. I take photos for them, full disclosure. So, but I saw the dress rehearsal, and and it was funny because I was, you know, one of very few people there because it was the dress rehearsal, and I was laughing a lot. And I felt kind of silly because I was the only one laughing, you know, because nobody else was there. But Vanessa Lemonides in the Carol Burnett role, and Bill Coyne as Byron Prong, the Jack Cassidy role. They're both really pretty terrific, and it's pretty great overall. And Peter, I don't know if you're aware of this, but NYU is doing Celebration.
Celebration. Oh, yeah, how about that? A wonderful score.
The Jones and Schmidt show. And
from 1969.
Right. And so I'm going to that on Sunday. So that's something I'm really looking forward to.
All righty. Great. So we'll catch up with all the new Broadway openings in the news in the next couple of weeks. Hopefully we have some new... interviews coming up. I'm not going to say who because we haven't confirmed them yet, but possibly somebody who is going to be running in the New York City Marathon that has a Broadway connection is going to come talk to us soon. And it is not Peter, Michael, or myself. You guys are not running this year, right?
No, it sure isn't me.
Okay.
Maybe it's Mark Cotton. You know, maybe he'll be running in the marathon to leave town. You know, who knows?
All right. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Learning you were wrong. Certain as the sun. Rising in the east, tale as old as time, song as old as rhyme, Beauty and the Beast. Tale as old as time, song as old as rhyme, Beauty and the Beast. Off to the cupboard with you now, Chip. It's past your bedtime. Good night, love.